3CR's Turn 40, and from Monday 10th of October right through to Saturday 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.
Women on the Line presents On the Record, 20 years of women's radio, an eight-part series chronicling key feminist issues covered on the program since 1986. I'm Maya Graham. On today's program, Survival, Aboriginal Women Speak Out, a range of Indigenous Australian women will be featured, talking about issues that have had significance for them, the struggles they've encountered and endured, and the importance of land and family.
We survived the Ice Age. We can survive the white man.
Sylvia Rubin from Palm Island, speaking there in 1987. On this show, you'll hear audio material from our comprehensive archives. You'll also be presented with critiques of government laws and inaction, the notion of Indigenous Australians having to traverse two worlds, and stories of survival and how to protest. But firstly, the momentous role that land plays. Let me take you back to 1988, the year that not everyone celebrated the 200th anniversary of the arrival of the First Fleet. This year also saw the opening of Parliament House on an Aboriginal site of significance. And when TV viewers saw the Queen there for the celebration, they were only shown half the story, with Aboriginal protesters kept at bay.
My name's Maureen Williams. I live in Sydney. I work with a local Aboriginal land council. With land councils, you know, you can only claim Crown land. That's the wrong title. That's Aboriginal land, not Crown land. All of this land's Aboriginal land. And the Gubbas are here and they're living on our land, you know, whether it's a concrete jungle now or not, you know, but to us it's Aboriginal land. And, you know, the Queen knows it. Mr. Hawke knows it too.
The next 10 years witnessed the establishment of, amendments to and restrictions on native title. First there was the Mabo case, where Parliament overturned the doctrine of terra nullius. Women on the Line's Andrea Baker elaborates.
In June 1993, a landmark High Court decision in Eddie Mabo's case recognised native title. The Native Title Act and Tribunal was established. This tested the common law rights of Indigenous people on Murray Island. There were no pastoral leases on Murray Island. This was yet to be tested.
The Wick decision in 1996 then established that the rights of Indigenous people could coexist with pastoralists. However, in 1998, Howard's then recently elected Liberal government responded by placing restrictions on land rights claims in the form of the Native Title Amendment Act, also known as the 10-point plan.
You know, when I first heard of it, 10-point plan, I said, oh, well, that was one step forward with native title, two steps backward.
That was Benita Mabo. This led to many protests and also to greater awareness within the mainstream of the Indigenous struggle for land rights. A rally was organised outside Parliament House in Canberra in defence of native title and reconciliation, and to coincide with the recommencement of the 10-point plan debate. National activist group Women for WIC were there attending the parliamentary debate, and WIC woman Dorothy from Arakun had the following to say.
Of course, the land has connections to us spiritually with our traditions and ceremonies of songs and language, like I said, but more than that is that even though we don't have connections, relationship to our land, where my land is from, but it's there always within me spiritually. Mm-hmm. And with this debate they're having with the 10-point plan and the native title, it's going to ruin it, and it means that our lives are in the hands of non-Aboriginal people, where they make decisions for us, not really understanding that we are the people still exist from within the Wick nations of the five generations. They have to understand that this is our land. We were here before centuries and centuries ago before they came here. We still got language, culture, ceremonies, tradition, custom, everything. So it is not only the 10-point plan. It is not the debate they're making to do amendments. It's people's lives are being affected, thinking we're dead. We're not there no longer. We don't exist. No, we're still here.
Also in 1998, Women on the Line produced two special series. The first, Women and Native Title, featured Lois O'Donoghue, former head of ATSIC, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, and also a spokesperson for Women for WIC.
Ooh, Aboriginal man.
I'm speaking from my heart, from my culture, my spirituality, and my law. I ask that all you women, and all the women of Australia, of all cultures, to support us in our fight to defend our native title rights. The federal government's proposed amendments to the Native Title Act is an attack on Indigenous women's lives, our religious beliefs, and our spiritual relationships with the land and sea. We do not accept the denial of our rights on pastoral leases and other land. We will not give up our right to negotiate, because the right to have a say over our country is our life. The right to negotiate enables us to protect our culture and our future.
The second series, Our Land, Our Culture, included some of the producers explaining what land meant to them.
Hi, I'm Elizabeth Dalton from the Gunai Kunai tribe of the area. I'm also from Gippsland FM. This is my land, and land means to me past, present, tradition, to maintain culture and links with the land.
And there are secrets in honour we must keep, and there are secrets that keep me from sleep, and there are secrets.
Now let's hear what has been said about the Australian government.
What the department forgot to do was treat people like they were people instead of animals.
Sylvia Rubin on Life on Palm Island. In 1990, the first Australian Tribunal of Women's Human Rights was held, and some of the testimonies given at the tribunal were showcased on Women on the Line. Millicent, a member of the Stolen Generation, had her story presented.
Hurt and humiliation were part of our everyday life. Years had passed and there was no contact with my family. My daughter was born September 25th, 1962. I was so happy I had my very own baby to love and cherish. They took my little girl away from me. They said she would be fostered out until I was able to look after her when I was old enough. The time came and I was allowed to leave the home. I approached the matron asking for the addresses of my family and the foster family who had my daughter. The matron told me she did not know where my baby was, and it was government policy not to give out the address.
Are there still two laws in Australia, one for whites and one for blacks? Many of our people say yes, and the proof is in the prison statistics. Prisons are the only place in this land in 1986 where Aboriginal people are often a majority. The proof is before you, and you've heard it tonight in the testimonies of some of the relatives of Aboriginal people who had recently died in police custody.
Helen Boyle, the chairperson for the Committee to Defend Black Rights. In 1983, a high number of Aboriginal deaths in police and prison custody was highlighted by the brutal death of 16-year-old John Pat. In 1986, a national speaking tour of relatives of those that had died in police custody took place at the public meeting in Melbourne.
As you've heard tonight, we are making a number of immediate demands, such as a call for a public inquiry or a royal commission. Do we expect to get very far with this call? We hope so. This tour has just begun, and already we know that the federal government is taking some notice. Perhaps we're making them feel a little guilty. But is this enough? We in the CDBR have been working for 3 years now on the issue of black deaths in custody. And some people may wonder, where are we getting? I believe that we're getting somewhere. Not only will this tour publicise the issue of Aboriginal deaths in custody all around the country, but we're hoping to get the movement of Aboriginal rights organised for action. All around the country, people have been organising meetings, contacting supporters, raising funds, etc., to make this speaking tour possible. I hope all this organising will carry over to other issues affecting our people. I hope that the tour will spark off a new mobilisation for Aboriginal rights and for justice, because we need it badly and we need it today. All we can say is that if we want a better future, it looks like we have to make it ourselves and we have to do it together.
In 1987, Women on the Line continued to hear about police harassment and surveillance of Aboriginal communities. Here is Ruth Barney.
For head of population, the percentage of Aboriginals incarcerated in jails far outnumbers that of white Australians. The offences that these Aboriginals are convicted of vary, but many are minor, such as abusive language. Jackie Payne is a solicitor with the Aboriginal and Islander Legal Service in Brisbane. She spoke to 5UV's Leslie Whiteman.
There is an incredibly high rate of Aborigines placed in custodial centres. If statistics were to believe, and if all things were to be equal between all people, statistics would indicate that Australian Aborigines were the most criminal people in the world. I think that such a suggestion would be absurd, and part of the problem and part of the reason for their incarceration must be discrimination by the police.
Despite Koori women making up 0.3% of the Victorian population in 1990, they then made up 8% of the prison population. Eleanor Harding, who worked with Aboriginal women in prison, talked at an action outside Fairlea Women's Prison in 1990.
Prison for Kooris is like another home. Our women are still in and out of prison because it's hard for them. They live in a riverbank. They live in a rubbish heap. Prison to Koori women, it's a home away from home because they got nothing. A lot of white women in prison, they never went through it the same way like Koori women. The hard life they have since they were kids. Jail in every state, there's always a lot of Koori women there. No one cares about them. We're the lost people in our own country.
You're listening to 3CR's 40 Days of Radical Radio Special, celebrating 3CR's 40 fabulous years of community radio.
Let's hear now about a very controversial case, that of the Hindmarsh Island Bridge, where marina owners wanted to build a bridge from Goolwa to Kumarank, known as Hindmarsh Island, and the traditional land of the Ngarrindjeri. Sandra Saunders, the director of the South Australian Aboriginal Legal Rights Movement, spoke to Women on the Line in 1995 and discussed some of the most important issues for Aboriginal people at this stage.
In the light of the court decision on the Hindmarsh Island when we lost the appeal, it means that this country is not yet ready to include Aboriginal law within Whitefellas law when making decisions. For us, it means that we have to now look at the law reformers in this country and get them to start recognising Aboriginal customary law, recognising that there's a way to deal with culture in this country that is respectful, but also that it can come out that Aboriginal people culture is protected. The Whitefellas law in this country really can't accept that there is secret and sacred information that can't be talked about, and they can't find ways to make decisions about that. And they're going to have to, otherwise Aboriginal culture is going to be further eroded.
Doreen Kartini was appointed by Ngarrindjeri elders to reveal information to the government on the secret women's business on Kumarank. This was a confidential submission, yet Shadow Minister Ian McLaughlin tabled some of the private documents in the South Australian Parliament.
Quite frankly, I think McLaughlin should never have been allowed to just resign because he misled the public. what he did by sneaking papers that he virtually stole, sneaking these papers to people opposing the claims of Aboriginal women, was immoral. It was an outrage, and I find it hard to believe that it also wasn't against the law.
Dr. Roberta Sykes there in 1995. ATSIC, the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Island Commission, led a troubled existence. The Commission had to comply with government institution requirements. They were given limited funding and they were then closed in mid-2004. In 1998, Andrea Baker explains the intended role of ATSIC.
The Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, ATSIC, was set up in 1990 as a vehicle for self-determination and self-management for Aboriginal people. A revolutionary commission, some argued, as it became the first time for Indigenous people to elect their representatives and then take their concerns to the Minister for Aboriginal Affairs. Here Aboriginal people would have a political voice and have some say over provision of services. Indigenous women were prominent players in establishing ATSIC. For example, Lois O'Donoghue became its first chairperson. Now, 9 years on, there are rumours that the federal coalition and government wants to gut ATSIC by two-thirds, therefore making the organisation ineffective.
Should it ever have been expected that ATSIC could fulfil the need created by over a century of neglect?
The fact is that we have this large unmet need that's been brought about because of historical reasons.
Mm-hmm.
And historically, the Commonwealth government didn't have responsibility for Aboriginal affairs, that this was largely seen as the domain of the state and territory governments. And until probably about 1967-68, there was in fact no discrete or direct funding for Aboriginal people or Aboriginal programs. So what you've had is sort of years and years of neglect, and here we are in the last sort of, you know, 20 to 30 years trying to play catch-up, but we're playing catch-up with a very limited capacity to meet that need because there's never been the level of funding that's been required.
Olga Havanen, Aboriginal activist and Chief Executive Officer of the National Indigenous Working Group. In 2004, Women on the Lines, Sam Sauerine, spoke to Colleen Marion, a former ATSIC Regional Councillor and Chair of the Western Suburbs Indigenous Gathering Place in Melbourne, about the impact of ATSIC being scrapped.
In the last month, both the Labor Party and the Federal Government have decided to scrap the Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander Commission, better known as ATSIC, 14 years after its inception. This signals the end to the system of elected government specifically for Australia's Aboriginal people.
The review doesn't say to abolish ATSIC, but to look at some of the problems and restructure it. And what we need is a national voice, and it's all about self-determination. I'd like to see that we look at the future that's going to ensure that every Aboriginal child that's born today has a future and to live in a safe and healthy environment. Yeah, and it's not happening. You know what? It's not happening.
In 1993, Eve Fiesel, head of the Centre for Koori Studies at Melbourne's Monash Uni, questioned the value of reconciliation for Indigenous people.
Why are we throwing away land rights and going through all this rubbish about reconciliation, spending over $40 million on it, taking over 10 years? Why aren't we addressing the issue of land rights and compensation? I mean, this talk of reconciliation, who's it for? We didn't make that decision. The government made this decision. So what does it mean for us?
Marion McGregor reports in 2000.
Last month saw the conclusion of 10 years of work by the Council for Aboriginal Reconciliation and that historic walk, 500,000 people across the Sydney Harbour Bridge. 500,000 Australians, according to the ATSIC chair Jeff Clark, meant the government had a mandate, to use the language the Prime Minister understands, to talk about an agreement, a treaty, with Indigenous people.
We had hoped, of course, that the reconciliation process, which was commenced in good faith, would result in an agreement between us as the Indigenous people and the Australian government on behalf of Australians. And unfortunately, under this government, the John Howard government, not even the most minimal draft of a statement was acceptable to him. Now, this is a tragedy for Aboriginal people.
Marcia Langton.
For so long we've had non-Aboriginal people talking on our behalf, setting up programs for us, which, you know, through experience you can see that they've failed because they haven't been determined by the community. You have to have time to consult. That was another problem I had working in the department, that, you know, they want decisions made straight away. I needed time to come back and consult with my community if I'm making decisions on their behalf or, you know, having input on their behalf. So, yeah, you know, the community expects you to consult, and that can take a long time, you know, to go around all the people that you have to deal with. And accountability and consultation is really important because of that historical thing of Aboriginal people not having a say in their own lives.
That was Faye Carter, the coordinator of community development programs at the Aborigines Advancement League, speaking to Women on the Line in 1988 for a special series called The Cost of Living. She spoke about Aboriginal women in the workforce.
Aboriginal women tend to try for jobs within the Aboriginal community and within the Aboriginal community organisations. And I don't think that that's so much because they're more comfortable working in that situation, but more so because Aboriginal women tend to work for a cause rather than a career. I think for any Aboriginal person there's a problem being a public servant, because ultimately you're accountable to the department, you're not accountable to your community. I know of quite a few Aboriginal women who have left good jobs in departments because of that reason.
That sense of having to cope with two opposing worlds has echoes in the criminal and justice system. Navigating the court system can be problematic for Aboriginal Australians, and misinterpretation is prevalent, as Jackie Payne explains.
This is a problem that we have at the legal services, whether or not we will call our clients to give evidence. It's nothing to do with whether or not they're telling us the truth, or we believe they're telling us the truth, or what their instructions to us are. It's the perception of other people have of when they are giving their evidence or when they are giving their statement. The problem that we often have is that if a black person is articulate, gives straightforward, unequivocal answers, they're often perceived to be cunning or sly. That has been said in the courts in which I've appeared. On the other hand, if as many Aboriginal people are very shy and they are slow in response, they don't always make eye contact with white people, they can at times agree to things that are put to them out of politeness, or they're concerned about people in authority, these sorts of responses are seen, are interpreted as that they are liars, that what they're saying is a fabrication, and any hesitation that they do is so that they can make up their story as they give their evidence.
This last part of the show will highlight some stories of protest, resistance and survival.
Palm Island has been the only Aboriginal reserve to hold a strike against white men. What a lot of people don't seem to realise too is that when they do that to you, when they hold you down, they make you all the more willing and stronger to fight, because you're more determined to do it.
That was Sylvia Rubin.
Hello and welcome to the first edition of Women on the Line for 1988. I'm Deb Welsh. Today and next week, Women on the Line point our microphones away from bicentennial self-congratulations, and we look at the major issue white Australia is trying to avoid, the status and situation of black Australia. This week, we focus on the massive Aboriginal protests in Sydney on the 200th anniversary of white settlement.
Yeah, it's a feeling of strength, you know, like, it doesn't matter how many black people you're with, how many of your own people you're with, could be one or two, that strength's there, but when you have so many people from different areas of this country, and they've got different types of culture too, it's a very strong feeling, it makes you very proud to be black. And it just goes to prove how old this country really is, and that our history goes back since time immemorial. And there's no way that they can say that this country is 200 years old. And you look at our tribal people, and they're still dancing and telling their stories. I think it's about time that white Australians started looking at the real history of this country.
What are you hoping for by the end of 1988 to have changed about Australia?
Well, to make people realise at least that this country isn't 200 years old, and that the bicentennial is a farce, and that it's important that Aboriginal history be taught to all children in this country, and not to lie to children, black or white, to tell them that Captain Cook discovered this country, to tell them the truth about what really happened and tell them the history of this country.
That was Frances Walker talking with Deb Welsh. Also in 1988.
This year sees the 21st anniversary of two changes to the Australian Constitution. Section 51 of the Constitution had given the state governments powers to make special laws for Aborigines, whilst the federal government had the power to make laws for any other race. And Section 127 stated that Aborigines were not to be counted in the census. Now, although these sections of the Constitution technically didn't deny Aborigines citizenship, they seem to imply both that Aborigines were less than human and that they didn't exist.
That was Deb Welsh. Faith Bandler, campaigner for the rights of Indigenous Australians, reflected on the efforts of 1967 and discussed the difficulties in garnering support and action from Indigenous people all over Australia.
The needs of the Aboriginal people were so great in their particular area that it was difficult to look beyond on a federal level. You know, the need for housing was so great. And the need for, well, we didn't talk about education then, that was almost a luxury. The need for housing and employment was just so great that it was difficult to get the people to think about something that was going to happen up in Canberra.
In 1994, Dr. Roberta Sykes spoke to Women on the Line about her recently published book, Morrowina, meaning Black Woman, Australian Women of High Achievement.
I particularly think young black children should read the book because it's such an inspiration to young black children that you can do something.
Mm.
And that image is missing out there in the wider public. They certainly, it's not something that they can get from their television because all they see on television is white people achieving. Mm. Here they can see black people achieving, and they can see that black people achieved despite hardship. It wasn't ever handed to them, any of them, on a plate. So I think that that's an important lesson.
That's all from me, Maya Graham. I hope you enjoyed today's show, Survival, Aboriginal Women Speak Out. You've been listening to a special series, On the Record, 20 Years of Women's Radio, which follows key feminist issues from the Women on the Line radio archives. There are 8 parts to the series, and if you missed any of them, you can download them from our website, www.womenontheline.org.au, or order a copy from 3CR on 03 9419 8377. Thanks to the Victorian Women's Trust for funding this historic project, and thank you to past contributors and presenters for making this show possible. Deep inside, for she's spiritual and she'll always be. If you'd like to contact the producers of Women on the Line, you can phone 3CR on 03 9419 8377 or email us at women_onTheLine@yahoo.com.au. The theme music for this series is Chop In by Minimum Chips. And on today's show, you also heard And There Are Secrets by Titus and Ruby Hunter's Modern Day Girl. I'll leave you now with another Titus song, My Sister.
Where we man, we fight for freedom. We're strong, we fight for peace. We struggle every day to prove our worth. We're women and we're proud to say what we are in ourselves. We've been hiding in the background far too long.
3CR's turn 40, and from Monday, 10th of October, right through to Saturday, 19th of November, we're celebrating. Join us on 3CR Breakfast from 8 until 8:30 a.m. Monday to Saturday as we delve into our rich 3CR archive and bring you half an hour of historic gems. So start your day with the sounds that built a station. 40 days of groundbreaking audio celebrating 3CR's 40 years of radical radio.